Wellness on today, April 11th, 2007. And we are opening a work session on House Bill 2469 and Representative Wolczek.
Good morning, everyone. For the record, I'm Tina Kotek, State Representative, House District 44 in North and Northeast Portland.
My name is Joel Fisher, Legislative Assistant to Representative Kotek.
Thank you for having us back for 10 of Take 2. Today, we do not have amendments ready, but what we thought would be helpful would be to provide a where are we now update from the work group discussions. We've had several meetings, and I want to appreciate everyone who's been involved in the work group, and I want to thank the chair for allowing us to not only have this work session, but some work sessions for next week. The plan at this point is to have amendments from Legislative Council by hopefully Friday morning, I think we're shooting for. And then Monday we have another work session scheduled, and if more questions are generated from that, we might need another one. But what we're going to provide today, has this been handed out yet? Do you have the summary? We have a summary, yes. That hopefully will, when you get the actual amendments from LC, will help.
This is it?
Yes. It's a section by section of what we've submitted in general summary. And I wanted to thank Representative Maurer and his staff person, Allison, and Joel Fisher, my LA. He's been working really hard, as well as the Department of Human Services. We've had, I don't even know how many hours of meetings on this. The work group that we convened was Representative Maurer, myself, staff from the department, Aaron Kelly Seal from the Governor's Office, Tom Hedberg from Child Support. We had representatives from the Oregon Center for Public Policy, the Oregon Law Center, and the Developmental Disabilities Coalition. So we had advocates and agency in the room, and we've come to, I think, very close agreement on most of the combination of House Bill 2469 and 2180. What you're going to be seeing in amendments are amendments to House Bill 2469. We decided.
Can you remind the committee what the other bill was?
Oh, House Bill 2180 was the agency bill.
Great.
And it was, we thought it would make the most sense just to have one bill to which to add amendments to, and that will be House Bill 2469. And what I would ask the committee is, I know we have about a half hour, is to just, if you have specific questions as we go through, we can come back to you with additional information, whether it's wording questions, and we can read some of the proposed language if that would be helpful, but you'll get more information in the amendments, and we can come back with any kind of policy or research background on any of the topics that you need. We'll just start making a list, and we'll get those to you. So on the summary, I'm going to grab my bill here. So in section one, I was just going to walk through this about where we're making changes to the bill. In section one, we're not proposing at this point any amendments, and this is probably one of the larger differences between my bill and House Bill 2180, but everyone agreed in the work group that continuing to use deprivation as a criteria for eligibility is not only bad policy but detrimental. It's a carryover from pre-welfare reform aid to families with dependent children. And what it does is really disincentive two-parent families from staying together. And I can provide more information on that. The one challenge with that is that there could be a fiscal on that because it would potentially increase the caseload because you're reducing an administrative barrier to the program. And when we get to the point of talking a little bit more about that, I would encourage the committee to think about this as a good policy choice and maybe allow Ways and Means to discuss this as a fiscal issue. But in terms of deprivation, I think the work group all agreed it's not good policy. Our goal is to keep parents together, especially two-parent families, if we can. And it really is and many states have gotten rid of this criteria. We just are one of the ones that still have it. Other states just count income as an eligibility. They don't look at the deprivation of the child by definition. Any questions about that? Because it's an important issue, and I want to see. Okay, moving on. Section 2, and Joel, feel free to jump in if I'm missing anything. Section 2 deals with a variety of things. We had long discussions about the assessment issue, client engagement. We've submitted language to strengthen the assessment and intake aspects of the bill to make it clear what we're actually going to be doing in improving that part of the program, making sure that the when you get in the door, the applicants are getting the proper level of assessment. One of the suggestions that Representative Maurer had was making reference to kind of the medical assessment model around physical and mental health as well, realizing, understanding this is there's a holistic approach to the assessment that's necessary to make sure that clients are going down the right track and getting the services they need. Section 2 also deals with the jobs program activities. In the original bill, we listed a variety of different types of work activities. We'll be deleting that list and just putting a more general statement around broad categories of suitable activities. We thought that would allow the department more flexibility than the list that's in here. We've had, moving on to page 3, the section around new parents. We had quite a bit of discussion about this, particularly around teen parents and just new mothers in general. The 2469, we had talked about what we currently have in the program is that after 90 days, after 3 months, a parent is required to go back into the jobs program's activities. Some states have that exemption to 12 months, others 24. And the bill had put in 12 months. And there was considerable discussion about how that would affect a particular population, teen parents. Feedback from providers were saying, we have to make sure we're engaging teen parents. 12 months is too long. And so what we're amending this to read would be to have teen parents re-engaged at 4 months and with a preference for educational activity, especially if they don't have their high school diploma or their GED, to make sure that that's the first preference. And if they do have those that level of education, encouraging post-secondary, certainly the teen parent would also have the option to go into more job connection activities, but trying to make a preference for education for that population after the four-month exemption. For other...
Representative Collins?
Mm-hmm. Yes, Representative.
Just a question about the fiscal impacts of that. Is that going to drive additional fiscal impact for this?
I don't think so. Those parents are still in the program as it is. Do you want to?
Yeah, I think it would be a pretty small fiscal impact. Currently, as I understand it, the DRA requires teen parents to be going back, be engaging after 3 months. So we're allowing them to not have to engage until 4 months. So there'd be a 1-month window there for a small percentage of the population that we would be funding with state-only dollars as opposed to the federal TANF block grant. But it's a very small amount of the population.
Follow up?
Okay, I understand that would be a real small impact. But the requirements between education and training, that doesn't change the amount of the grants or any. So that doesn't affect the fiscal.
I don't believe so. I think it's just, stating curious. A preference because it's... There are available activities now. It's just saying that you know, as a value statement, trying to promote that as a path necessary than job attachment.
Okay. Thank you.
You see Dave nodding back there. We might have from the department come up. But we're getting good at this. We're lay advocates here, you know, working on a very complicated program. I think we're getting it all right. On the new parents, other parents outside the teen parents, again, more...
Might have the department up for
It might be helpful, Dave. He can nudge me if we get it.
Yeah.
If we get it wrong.
Just identify yourself.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, for the record, my name is David Lida. I'm with Children, Adult, and Families Department of Human Services.
And one of our stalwarts on the work group. So for the other parents, again, we had 12 months in the original bill, and there was a discussion at the Family Services Review Commission, which is the advisory group to the self-sufficiency programs, and we've gotten some feedback that, again, 12 months might seem too long. And, you know, the goal is the longer the parent can stay with the child, I think the better outcomes we have. But there's also an understanding that we're trying to balance re-engagement. So The amendment will recommend moving that to a six-month exemption, so that our current program is at 3 months. We'd move it to a six-month exemption from requiring participation in the jobs activity. There's also a limitation that we'll be putting in that six-month exemption per child, and capping parents at 12 months of participation from 12 months of an exemption per parent, because the federal guidelines talk about capping families 12 months total for an exemption for infants. So am I getting that right? Okay.
With exceptions on an as-needed basis. Both of those, originally the HB 2469 had 12 months of exemption per child. So we're making a significant jump to go ahead and cap it at 12 months per client, regardless of how many children we make, and a significant jump to go from 12 months to 6 months per child. So we're adding in that there would be exceptions to both of those time limits on an as-needed basis that could be decided by rule by the Department of Human Services.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
And that is a pretty significant change in the program.
It is, and I think, again, it's going to get to the outcomes we want. You know, the longer the attachment, this is a very vulnerable population, and I know there's discussion in the you know, we've had some discussions here around family leave and what we do in the regular workforce, and understanding that, I would argue that the longer we can provide parents to be home with their kids as much as we can, I think that they're going to have stronger outcomes. Again, balancing that with, you know, how long is that period? And, the 3 months that we currently have is, I think, way too short. I think the 6 month is a good compromise to what we originally had in the bill. And
I think what Representative Mauer is referring to is the cap.
You are correct. It's the cap. It's a disincentive from years past and the way welfare was treated and how people gained the system.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think this creates the appropriate middle ground of incentive and disincentive to do the other thing. So
that's correct. And I think, you know, we're always struggling with, there's the public perception of the program, and then having an outlet, some kind of rule set aside, any kind of hardship that would make sense to continue to exempt that mother, you know, if they're suffering from long-term postpartum depression or something like that, that there would be some rules that there could be a, you know, an exemption for on a particular case-by-case basis. So on Section 3, we move into the discussion around the child support pass-through. We talked pretty much at length during the public hearing, and the importance of passing through a portion of the child support that is collected on behalf of TANF families to not only provide a little extra resource, but to encourage non-custodial parent engagement. And we came to agreement that we would have the child support in there. We want to clarify that it would be a pass-through of $50 of a client's child support payments per month per child. And I want to make a change on the document that you have in front of you on line 3 there, where it says to a total of 200 of child support per client. That should be 100. That's what the new federal regulations are allowing. So it should be, so it's $50 per child up to a total of $100 per family. And another important issue is that the amendment will have the department disregarding child support as countable income, which is important for making sure other resources are available. The child support pass-through will be reviewed every 2 years for the purposes of determining possible changes in federal regulations. So with a recognition that things could change with associated fiscal impact, that we need to be reviewing the child support policy change. There's a little, as you see in the next bullet there, we'll have to change the 200 to 100 there,
right,
as well. And it's a little discussion of why we need to do it. There is a potential fiscal on doing the child support pass-through, primarily to the child support division that receives that money for child support enforcement. Again, Tom with child support division was on the work group. We are aware of the fiscal, and the governor's office is also aware of that. And I think there's general support for that because this is a good policy choice. It's be around $1 million that is not currently in the governor's budget. Another topic of large discussion was sanctions, and probably the one that I'm still not completely comfortable with in terms of what we're going to be amending the bill. 2469 did not have any it talked about sanctions, but in a way that wasn't as explicit as that agency's bill in 2180. The agency was also suggesting full family sanctions, and we heard from the advocates, and I think the research has shown it's unclear whether partial sanctions or full family sanctions, partial being you just remove the adult grant when you're trying to sanction someone to encourage anticipation, or full family where you're taking away the child portion of the grant as well. I think the research is not clear that either one is, which one is more effective. I do think I'm concerned about full family sanctions having an impact on the child. But what we will be recommending is full family sanctions within a specific timeline. But what we're adding in is very specific language about at what threshold can we initiate those full family sanctions. And we're adding language in there to talk about assessment and making sure that certain levels of assessment have been completed before we go to the next step of doing the full family sanctions. And that's the compromise. I don't know. Do you want to add anything on that, Joel?
Yeah, it was an interesting process.
Well, each time it changed, could you just say your name?
Yeah. My name is Joel Fisher. It's been a really interesting process to try and figure out how we could get to some sort of a compromise around full family sanctions. We wanted to really be able to define who this population was that would get a full family sanction, and it's, you know, really the only the people who absolutely most need it. So we included language in there that I think gets pretty specifically at it. So I can read it to you, but it says, let me make sure I have it. Sanctions are appropriate only when it is clear that there is both no barriers to participation. So after we've already assessed all these barriers and it's confirmed by an appropriate agency or professional with the expertise of type of assessment being engaged in, it's clear that the caretaker relative has the ability to comply but is willfully noncompliant. So we say out there just as plain as day who it is the people are that we really need the full family sanction for.
Thank you, Joel.
Thank you, Joel. And what we'd be adopting is some of the original language from 2180 that the agency suggested, which it wouldn't be a permanent removal of the grant. Once re-engagement happened, then the grant would be restored. But again, this is something I think we have to think about how we're doing this. But we have to make sure the safeguards are in place that we're not unduly harming the child by going to full family sanctions too quickly. So that's something we should look at when you get the amendments. I'd appreciate any feedback on that. We're going to add an amendment that we term accountability, but basically it's asking the department twice a year to report back to the Family Services Review Commission the status of the clients who have been sanctioned to assess how that's working. So we have some feedback mechanism around the particular sanction issue. Section 4, there were no changes. It was a housekeeping section. Section 5, time limits. So under the Deficit Reduction Act and the reauthorization of TANF, the expectation is there's a 60-month time limit on participation in the TANF program. And we are making some amendments to add what the types of federal exemptions are from the time limits to clarify that. There are some exemptions for hardship. We have some of that in there already. We're just clarifying that a little more. We're also adding an amendment that is trying to get an issue that came up rather last minute, which is how do we deal with families who have been on TANF in other states and the amount of time they spent on the program and how does that count towards our time limit? So what we have in there is we were trying to figure out when we'd start counting their time spent in other states, and I think we need to work on this. I don't think we've totally thought through how that would impact, but we realize it's an issue we have to, you know, clarify in the statute. I don't know, Dave, if you want to mention anything about that.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee.
Your name again, Dave
Lida, Department of Human Services. The federal rules apply to all states as far as the number of months that people can receive assistance, regardless of what state they're in, for the 60-month time limit. And so what we were, and part of the discussion is around people that would move to Oregon, and then how many of their and under what rules their months that they receive federally funded assistance in other states would apply to our time limit. The House Bill 2469, as written, doesn't really specifically address that issue. And so we're thinking that we need some amendments to clarify what our position is going to be on whether we're going to give explicit exemptions to people for a period of time, which would be what was our proposal in 2180, that there would be a kind of a period of time that we would more or less provide a hardship for folks moving into the state, but then at a date certain, that particular hardship would go away. And so it's just figuring out the nuances of exactly how we want to handle that policy.
And in conversations with legislative council, we also have to be careful about constitutionality of not somehow disadvantaging a certain population based on moving into the state. So we have to figure out that language. But I think one of the bigger issues around time limits that we had extensive conversations on is how do we handle, there's a set of hardship criteria that the state can exempt up to 20% of its caseload when they reach the time limits based on these hardships. But we had a discussion about what do we do with families who, during that 60-month period, they could have had a long period of hardship. For example, maybe during that 5-year period, they had 2 years of living in a domestic violence situation. It really inhibited their ability to go and move on and continue on the path to self-sufficiency. What we're creating in the bill is allowing the department to track some of that and to essentially bank those months of hardship. So if the family reaches the 60 months and the state has basically used up its 20% exemption for their caseload, that family could utilize the banked months that during the hardship to extend their time limit. So we haven't quite worked out all the details, but we're trying to put something in the bill to make sure that we're really paying attention to what's going on for families and not just have this arbitrary, yep, you're done, get off the program. Because that's, again, not getting back to the outcomes we want, which is success for the kid and the family. Did you want to add anything to that, Joel? Did I get that up right?
My name is Joel Fisher. I think that gets at the crux of it, it is a difficult issue, and I can explain it in pretty explicit detail if anybody has any questions or would like it. It gets into some of the funding nuances between state and federal funding, but if folks are interested, I can go into more detail.
Thank you, Joel. And that actually reminds me, I didn't mention at the beginning, but you probably recall from last time we had this big discussion about how we were going to designate in the bills what portions of the changes were going to be federally funded, what were going to be state funded. And we had long discussions with a variety of people, and legislative fiscal was basically like, you don't want to put some of that information in statute because it's too restrictive. Really, we don't do that for other programs. So when we come back on Monday, we're going to have a little chart that talks about the intention around the different parts of this change to the program. Because what we want to do is provide in the record the intent around the different types of funding sources, and that would be the basis, not only here but in Ways and Means more primarily. So that would set the basis for understanding how we're going to do the budget on this. So some parts are going to be state only, some parts will be federal. In this case, we have some federal up to the 20% exemption, on top of that some state funded. So we'll try to explain that a little bit more on Monday, but we've tried not to include the language around the types of funding sources because we were told that's not a good thing to do, and the department is okay with that.
Dave, will you be having your amendments? It sounds like the kinds of things you're going to be working on. Will your amendments be available on Monday, do you think, or are you still going to be working on them?
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, Dave Light of DHS. Our understanding is that we'd be moving forward with the House Bill 2469, and so we're working with the representative staff on that set of amendments. That would be the bill that would go forward. So at this point, we're not making separate amendments.
I understand that. Oh, but didn't you say that you were going to be working on some amendments on this bill?
Yes.
And that's what I'm asking. Will those amendments be ready by Monday?
I believe so. I think we're talking about the same amendments that Joel was referencing.
Okay.
As well.
And originally, the department had started to draft amendments for their bill. And so the goal is to have what we're calling the omnibus amendments.
Right.
We're going to have everything
right.
in one package with we're all in agreement. So
great.
Yeah.
I just want to make sure that all the stakeholders have time to see these amendments and get feedback to you and also to the committee on those.
Absolutely.
Great.
And that's one of the reasons they're not ready, because we wanted to make sure we're making sure we're all as close to agreement as we can because it's pretty lengthy. And I want to thank Lori Freeman and Legislative Council. She's trying to draft these. So,
good.
And there's a little bit more information on the time limits there on page 3 of the document. On section 6, this gets into the post-TANF program. To remind everyone, this is one of the primary tools to get at the new requirements around work participation, creating an income supplemental program. Once someone has basically reached the max on their income, that they would be placed into what we're calling a post-TANF program. There'd be a monthly stipend to provide that support, and we'd be able to count their employment activity into our work participation rates. We have a couple small amendments in there dealing with the issue of transitional medical assistance, making sure that we're not somehow setting up a barrier to continue transitional medical assistance depending when someone comes into the program and when they get attached to the post-TANF program. And then we wanted to clarify at what point the department, what they need to do to reengage someone who's in the post-TANF program but might not be participating, and the department wanted to make sure that, you know, how do we make sure, because we're counting on those folks to count towards our work participation. If they're not engaged in the program, might be an issue. So we'll have some language in there to talk about making sure that engagement is happening. Section 8 is the discussion on the state family SSI-SSDI program. This is the state-funded program to help folks who might be better served by applying for SSI or SSDI. We have some small changes in one amendment around adding needy caretaker relative into the first line there to clarify this is for TANF clients. We will be pegging the adult grant amount to 43% of the SSI adult standard payment. We'll have 50%. That's the fiscal amount that was assumed, so we're pegging that at 43%. It clarifies that the amounts that we would get back from the federal government once someone is engaged in approved for SSI, that we would be recovering the adult portion of the grant. So as you remember, once someone is on, then we get basically reimbursement back from the federal government. And in response to Representative Gelser's concerns and others, we're adding in some language that talks about opportunities to work. Catherine White with the Developmental Disabilities Coalition has been working with us to draft something requiring participants to participate in appropriate activities, that participants have access to other suitable services. The idea that this isn't some track that folks go down and then don't have access to other types of opportunities. So we'll have some clarifying language in on that. No other changes in sections 9 through 20, and then we'll be adding a new section at the end. We need an emergency clause because we are under, you know, expectations of the federal government is we're starting to implement this as soon as we can. So that's the summary, and hopefully when you get the amendments, this will, you can put these side by side. And are there particular questions, or I know that was rather quick, but once you see the language, I think more of it will make sense. But are there particular areas that people would like additional information on that we could provide before Monday?
You've done a phenomenal job.
Yeah. Madam Chair, I just want to thank Tina and Joel for their hard work, because they really have taken the lead on this. This is a major change to a substantial program for DHS, and we have to do it. I mean, there's no option. We don't have the option to punt on this one. And so the cooperation between DHS and all the stakeholders was very evident in that work group. So it was a pleasure to work with Tina on this.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Everyone's worked really hard. This is a substantial piece of legislation. We're making some major changes here. And I know the Oregonian, for example, is going to be doing some coverage of this, so just be forewarned. But, I think the department has been really very quiet. I mean, they see it as an opportunity. We see it as an opportunity. Everybody says this is the time to make some changes to the program. And I'm looking forward to passing on the best policy bill to Ways and Means, where then we can, frankly, duke it out on what might be some additional fiscal. Because right now there's $20 million earmarked in the co-chairs as well as the governor's budget for these changes. But we're adding the child support. There's the discussion around deprivation. But again, our job is to – this is what's the best policy, and then let's try to make an effort to fund it when we get to Ways and Means. So,
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, Dave Lida. I wanted to echo the appreciation for all the hard work for the representative, other representatives on the work group, the advocates, and all involved in kind of working through these nuances of the compromise between the two bills. I think it's been a phenomenal job that folks have done on that. I wanted to also just mention, you know, the issue around the fiscal, and we have some preliminary figures around around the size of the fiscal for deprivation. I think we're in agreement that changing the policy would be good for families, but the fiscal's not in the governor's recommended budget. Also, I wanted to add that there would be a substantial fiscal on the changing the transitional medical assistance as well, that's not in the GRB.
Okay, thanks, Dave.
Thank you, Dave.
Representative Cowan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just would like to add my appreciation as well. I think it's great when we need to make necessary policy changes and we can develop that into something that's going to be better for people. My bottom line is always what's ultimately the most cost effective, and I guess that's what I would like to say at this point, is that while we look at some fiscal impact up front, if ultimately the end product means that we're spending less money in the long range, at the same time making people's lives better, I think it's really important that we focus on that as well. And this summary makes something so complicated very understandable, and I really appreciate the help with that.
Well, we're trying, and really the bulk of the praise should go to Joel. Joel's been working nonstop on this 24/7, so we're trying to make it easy. It's, you know, you're all going to be experts when we get to the floor, hopefully. So, thank you.
Any other questions? You don't think you're going to be an expert?
So watch for those amendments. They're coming.
All right. Thank you. We look forward to that. Thank you all
thank
so
you.
Much. All right. We will close the public hearing, or the work session on 2469, and open up a work session on 3113, which amends the duties of the Department of Human Services to include investigations of allegations of child abuse at child care facilities. Representative
Maurer. Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm Representative Ron Maurer, House District 3. And we bring to you a -1 amendment for 3113. And we also are requesting that we not move it as it reads. There are a couple changes that need to be made, and the copies of the -1 that you have are highlighted with a couple word changes, wordsmithing.
Yes. Do we have the -1?
You know, I don't.
The -1s are coming to you.
Okay.
Thank you.
As we speak with the -1.
Thank you.
Oh, you have
okay.
Thank you.
Oh, you got a little wine.
Okay.
Well, that's not that much enough.
Okay.
Thank you. And the bottom line on 3113 is this is about filling a crack between two systems, between child welfare and between law enforcement. It's not about changing a program. It's not about changing the way people do business. But home or in-home child care is a substantial piece of many children's lives, many families' lives, good or bad. But the reality is that we need to have the ability to investigate those allegations of child abuse without having two bureaucracies not see eye to eye and how they're going to handle that. And so this bill, with the amendments, does that. It just is essentially clarifying language for both DHS and for law enforcement so that they don't look past each other to make these investigations happen. And so,
Representative, you mentioned family child care. Wouldn't this apply to all child care facilities?
That is correct.
Okay, thank you. Go ahead.
And basically, I'm going to close with that, knowing that we are going to bring forward, I would assume, a -2 to make this clarifying language more specific so that everybody is on board, including, of course, the department needs to be on board. So at this time, I'll take any questions.
Has the department been involved in these amendments?
Yes, they have. They're here.
Okay.
They're here.
Okay, we will call them up, but look, before you leave, let's ask if there are any questions. Representative Kotek.
Thank you, Madam Chair. No question, but I just want to say thank you. I've talked to some of the folks, and this is an issue that's kind of been needed clarification for a while, so thank you for working on this. This is good.
Thank you.
Why don't you stay, and we'll invite Una. Are you wanting to come up? Mickey, are you wanting to come up, or are you just going to let Una? Okay. I'm sure she can.
For the record, Chair Tomei and members of the committee, I'm Una Swanson, the Child Protective Services Program Manager for the department. And we received the amendments yesterday about 5 o'clock, and I had a chance, appreciated a chance to see those, and made a few comments to, I believe it was Allison on the phone, about just some things that we saw. We're very supportive of the concept and supportive of the clarification. As I look at the proposed amendments, I'm not sure that captures exactly where we thought it should be, but we'd like to continue to work with the representative and others as we move toward a dash two.
Okay, so I just want to clarify. You have a dash two in the works?
Yep.
And so what you're suggesting, Una, is that perhaps there needs to be more work between the department, even on top of the dash two, so you're looking at the possibility of a dash three, correct?
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, I'm not aware that a dash two has actually been created, and we're just sort of discussing the language right now. So I'm hoping that I think because it primarily impacts the department and their role in these, that we are being offered this opportunity to work with them on the language and make sure that it gets us, I think, where they would like it to be, and then we can make our changes in rule.
And Madam Chair, I will comment that we will not bring forth another set of amendments without the department's approval.
Good. That's great. I appreciate that. Good. Any other questions of either of these two witnesses?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Una, is the concern where the amendment's being done, where the change is being made, or the... I wanted to get a sense of what the concerns are.
Chair Tomei, Representative Kotek, as we look at the amendment as it's written and the suggested changes, one of the things that we need to continue to make clear, the language as written in Section 2 says the alleged child abuse occurred in a child care facility as defined in the ORS, and the department shall investigate, or I think they're adding cause, and we just continue, we need to continue to make clear that if there's a crime that's been committed, we work hand in hand with law enforcement, and I think the goal is that we will have a specific role in these rather than as requested by law enforcement. I think that's the goal, is that we would respond to these and be involved in these, but we just need to continue to be clear that if there's a crime that's been committed, law enforcement takes the lead and we work with them in that regard. We just want to make sure that language goes in that way.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
So you just want to really just kind of define that a little bit better and narrow
Correct.
That down for the lead role.
Correct.
Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I had a question at the end in the subsection 4. I don't understand the language where it says if a child is taken into protective custody by the department shall promptly make reasonable efforts to ascertain the name and to the examination described in subsection 6 of this section. So I was confused both about where subsection 6 is and what the name is that's being... Is that the name of the child or the name of the parents?
Chair Tomei and Representative Gelser, I would like to say I have the statute memorized, but I don't. It's possible that someone in the back has the rest of the statute. The other pieces aren't there.
We have somebody's coming.
Yes.
Up. And she's got a very thick book.
Okay. Over here. I don't believe there are any changes being recommended to that part
okay.
of the statute.
Could you identify yourself, please?
My name is Linda Goss. I'm with the Attorney General's Office here at the request of the Department of Human Services. Chair Tomei and Representative Gelser, I think one of the problems is that you're missing page two.
Oh,
that could be.
Yeah,
so that would be true. Very helpful. That's why it's so confusing.
Thank you. I feel better now.
Very well. I don't need a lawyer for that. But I can. That section. Excuse me. Let me just get to that.
You don't need, okay. Madam Chair. That makes sense. I should have looked at the bottom. I couldn't understand why I couldn't understand that, and I was feeling not very
it doesn't
smart.
Read very
Thank
well.
You,
Madam Chair. We just want
Thank
to
you.
Give a prize to Representative Gelser. Look on her feet. That wasn't her question.
Any other questions?
Brutal.
Yeah. Linda, I suspect there may be a fiscal to this.
Chair Tomei, yes, the department has prepared a fiscal related to this this House bill.
Okay. And I just want sort of a discussion that our understanding is that as the law is now, that the department does not get involved in these. The report would go to a law enforcement person and then go to the DA's office to see if there is going to be any reason for them to bring charges against someone. Is that correct? Is that correct?
Chair Tomei, not. No, the department or law enforcement can receive a report of child abuse in a child care facility. Either entity receives the report, and as a policy decision in the state, law enforcement responds as the primary, and we respond to assist law enforcement with interviews. If it's a family daycare home and the daycare provider is also a parent, we get involved directly with those. If it's a daycare facility and it's an employee that's the identified perpetrator, we often assist with interviews, but there are times that we don't, depending on the situation, because it is primarily an unrelated person who's the identified perpetrator. So those we have been less involved with and have responded as to assist law enforcement, but we're not a primary in that. And I'd like to refer to Representative Olson to see if that's been his experience.
That's accurate.
Well, if I remember from our previous discussion of this, we were hoping to change that.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And so that's what is going to be worked on, correct?
Yes, Madam Chair. You're talking about the reporting piece,
correct,
and the investigation. And I think
because
that...
Because our interest is not just in prosecuting somebody. Our interests are in providing services to that child and that family, as well as dealing with the perpetrator, correct?
But also bringing the department's expertise into the investigation of the child abuse, and because they bring a different skill set than law enforcement does in this situation. And this, of course, goes back to a very specific situation that occurred within my district, where we had people doing this doesn't show up on the transcript, but doing this, and that was deemed to be inappropriate.
Right. So this is really a pretty dramatic change that we're looking at.
I don't know if dramatic. I would say this is a clarification in language so that we don't have people looking beyond the other agency. Law enforcement and DHS are by statute going to be required to work together very closely in these situations, where before it was unclear.
Linda, do you want to respond to that?
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, I agree that I think the goal is that there's consistency in perhaps what we might call a joint response from the department and from law enforcement, and department would bring the skill set that they have to offer to that situation, and law enforcement would bring the criminal investigation side. And I, it's at least my understanding that it isn't so much about whether there's a prosecution, although that's important, but it's to be sure that there's an adequate both social service assessment and criminal law enforcement investigation in those settings where children are cared for. That's my understanding.
Representative Gilliam, did you have a question?
Well, yes, I did. Thank you, Madam Chair. One of the reasons I'm supportive of this is because the department does have so much to offer, and it's just because we a law enforcement agency takes the lead, they somehow would disappear or not be informed, I think is a terrible omission. But I wanted to go back to something that you said, and could you just describe or define an unrelated person? It was back a couple questions ago, so I'm not sure of the context, but I think it was in relationship to who might be accused of child abuse, and you said unrelated, and I wondered if you could clarify who that is.
Chair Tomei and Representative Gilliam, certainly. In our administrative rule, the way in which we approach child abuse situations, we distinguish between what we call familial, and familial can be the parent or caregiver in the home. We also identify there may be a boyfriend, a partner who's living in the home, household members that live in the home, live in family situation. We also look at the extended family, grandparents, uncles, cousins, those relationships that last over time and their connections. As far as unrelated individuals, of course, it could simply be a neighbor, a stranger abuse. We also look at situations where individuals are in a position to provide teaching or coaching or limited care, and that would be child care, where there hasn't actually been a transfer of the parental responsibility to the caregiver, but they have a more limited responsibility for a short period of time. So those are the kinds of things that we would consider as unrelated.
And follow up?
Follow up.
And if a child's at a care facility, whether it's a home or a commercial facility, there's obviously the potential for more unrelated, possible unrelated exposure to abuse. Would that be right?
Chair Tomei, Representative Gilliam, are you saying that if a child's in a daycare center, there's more likelihood that there would be additional, they'll have access to additional people, more people, and in the context of that, the idea that they may be abused by someone other than a family member is higher,
yeah.
I suppose.
Chair, what do I do when they ask me a question?
I think you have to answer that.
Okay. Do I? Okay, I'll answer. Yeah, except I don't want to make it sound like I think there's more likelihood that there's abuse, but there's more likelihood of exposure to other adults in other situations that would be less, there'd be less control than there would be, at least theoretically, in a home. That's what I meant.
Yeah.
Which all goes back to the reason I think this is a good idea to have your expertise. You know, it doesn't matter where it happens. You've got, as the representative pointed out, you have a skill set that comes to bear no matter if it's in a home or in any other kind of facility.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, we are supportive of this concept, and I think that we said in the last hearing it's a conversation we've been having with the child care division for some time, and we have looked at other state models, and while there's a variety of ways that these are handled, we think that moving in this direction is an improvement.
Great. All right. Thank you all very much. Thank you for working on this important bill. Okay. I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 3113 and open up a public hearing on House Bill 2752. And I see a good representative here who I think is going to be talking with us. This bill modifies the Working Family Child Care Income Tax Credit to allow credits to be claimed for child care costs of taxpayers with disabilities that prevent them from providing child care, being employed, or attending school. It applies to tax years beginning on or after January 1st, 2007.
Good morning, Madam
Good
Chair.
Good morning.
Many. Kick off my testimony for you. Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee for hearing this bill. This is a relatively simple bill, and House Bill 2752 is basically designed to give families who have one of the parents that's disabled the opportunity to collect the Working Family Child Care Income Tax Credit. Currently, tax credit is not available to families where one of the parents has to stay at home because they're disabled, but their disabilities do not allow them to care for the child. So it puts an extreme economic burden on that kind of a family that's left with one breadwinner, essentially, in the household. And, you know, frankly, a lot of families are able to take advantage of this tax credit, and this just seems to be unfair to this particular segment of our population. It's not probably a huge segment of our population, but I think this bill just is trying to fix that little simple problem. And I see Representative Klim, who is also the chief sponsor on this bill, with me on this. This came to both of us, actually, in a from different constituents. I have a constituent in my district that this happened to, or that complained about this scenario, having a tough time making ends meet and having to pay for child credit while one of the parents is left at home and unable to take care of that child. And I think this is a good bill, and I hope you do move it on so that we can work out a few of the minor technical aspects of this bill. But I think the general concept is pretty simple, and appreciate your hearing and here to answer any questions. And maybe Representative Klim would like to say a few words as well.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm Brian Klim, State Representative from here in Salem, Central and East Salem. And really, the more important part is having my constituents who are here to testify talk, so you can talk to them about what they're going through. But as I heard the tail end of Representative Holvey's comments, it's, I think, a fairly common sense, logical approach that if somebody is so disabled that the state and others determine them to be unable to work, any of us who've done some sort of either child care duty in our own families or for someone else, we know that it is a full-time job, probably more than a full-time job, and that person really can't be expected to do that and really unable to do that. And therefore, we sort of have them in the same position that two working parents would have, where they're eligible for the child care tax credit because they're both unable to, they're both doing other things that make them unable to care for the child. And I just would like to see a remedy to, I don't think it was an intentional situation caused, but I think it's probably more widespread than we realize. Just Representative Holvey, I happen to have two people who came to us and talked about it, but I have a feeling it's in more places in Oregon than some of us might think until we get the bill out there, and then people might come forward. So I understand working through the process to see what the fiscal is and all that kind of stuff is part of this. But I appreciate you hearing it, and I think you're going to hear the more important testimony here in a moment.
Thank you, Representative. Any questions of these two? All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And for the record, I would state Representative Paul Holvey never introduced myself. Representative Kotek was just in our committee testifying a few minutes ago, so we probably could have traded bills. Thank you very much for your hearing.
Thank you, Representative Paul. Are you going to stick around, or are you going back to committee?
I can if you wish.
I'd like you to, if you wouldn't mind.
Okay, great.
You may have more questions. Hi.
I typed up our testimony for you to have a copy also. I am Patricia Hand. I go by Trish. And I'll let my husband introduce himself.
Good morning, Mike. My name is Tim Hand, and I look forward to testifying.
We want to thank you for the opportunity to explain why this bill is so important to us and so many other families like us. I work full-time at the Sheriff's Office, and Tim is disabled due to Crohn's disease. We have an adorable little boy, Logan, 2.5 years old, who is very active and attends daycare. Due to Tim's illness, he is often at the doctor's and often frequently hospitalized. And when he's hospitalized, it's to clear blockage, and it usually takes about 5 days. So that leaves me single parent for 5 days. And then when Tim is not in the hospital, he has up to 8 doctor's appointments per week. Some of them are only 15 minutes. Some of them last 6 hours. So those appointments really aren't suitable to haul a 2.5-year-old with him. One of the contributing factors to Tim's Crohn's disease is stress. And as anybody will attest, 2.5-year-olds sometimes are stressful. We feel the Department of Human Services has deemed Tim to be unable to work. And like Representative Clem was saying, that taking care of a child is a full-time job, and Tim's just not able to take on that responsibility. So we're asking for your support in the House bill so that we can receive the tax credit that other people do qualify for. Do you have any questions of us?
Thank you so much for coming to testify, both of you. Any questions? Representative Kotek.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's nice to see you again. I have some comments and then just a clarifying question. So when I first saw this bill come through, I had worked on the Working Family Child Care Credit back in 2001 when we made it refundable. And this was a red flag for me. I'm like, I read the summary, and I was like, what are we talking about here? And then Trish came in and talked to me, which I'm really glad you did, because the goal of the credit is to help working families. And this family has child care costs. And there's this assumption, because it's a two-parent family, that Tim can be taken care of Logan. That's not the case, but you have child care costs. And what I'm being told is that the revenue department, when you've applied, they say, no, you don't qualify because, you know, really you have someone else in your household who should be doing your child care. You don't need to be paying for child care. So my understanding is how this would work is you'd be able to apply like anyone else to have a refund on your child care costs that you are incurring because of your family situation.
Correct.
And I don't know if we need to clarify this is for joint filing or for two-parent families. I don't know if we need that kind of clarification. I don't know, but that was one thing I was thinking as you were talking, but this makes sense because the intent of the credit is to help folks with their costs so they can stay working. Because if you didn't, you wouldn't be able, if you don't have your child care, you're not going to end up working because you don't have someone else to help you with your child care. So I'm really glad you brought this forward. And I would guess there's probably other folks that have this issue. It's, you know, we have.
He had been told there's other people. And as Representative Holvey was saying, he was working on a similar bill at the same time when we came up with the idea that something should be done. Can I state a little bit about the background of
Absolutely.
Why we did this? When we applied, they denied it, and we were asked if we wanted to appeal, and we said definitely yes. And we waited for several months before we heard anything. And this application was for last year?
2005.
Oh, it was 2005. That's how far back we are. And we were denied on appeal. And why we came up with this idea is because we found out through the process that the law is written, it's written in a narrowed text, and we're just trying to broaden the base to cover people with disabilities who are unable to go to school or work or care for their children.
Madam Chair, in our denial process, they sent us letters telling us of other court cases of other people who had been denied in similar circumstances as ours. One, the wife is disabled, and they put their child in daycare while the husband goes to work, leaving them with child care costs and only one person working. But the wife, due to health issues, is unable to care for a child. So we know that there's other cases out there that have also been denied. We only found out about it in doing our 2005 taxes because somehow they managed to let our 2004 go through. So we are waiting for the letter telling us that we need to refund them the money that we did actually receive for the 2004 tax period. And then they've denied us the 2005 because it was a greater amount. I think that's what flagged it out to them. I think the first one was like $100 due to the fact Logan was in daycare maybe 2 months of that entire tax period. But the greater amount flagged it out to them, so then it came to our attention that something needed to be adjusted in this bill so that other people could take advantage of that.
Thank you, Trish. Any other questions? Representative Geltzer.
I'm just kind of, thank you, Madam Chair, processing in my mind the many different ways that disabilities can impact the ability to access child care. And
I'm sorry, go on.
Thank you. And I'm thinking in particular of families that have children with disabilities where a parent is unable to work because they're needing to take that child frequently to the hospital for the child's frequent hospitalizations. The second parent is unable to work because someone needs to be taking that child to the doctor. For the same reasons that are described here, the other children need child care because it's not appropriate for them to spend their toddlerhoods and infancies up at Emanuel or Dornbecker. So I'm curious why it would be limited only to the parent having a disability and rather than families who, again, are not able to work because of the impact of disability on their lives. Process question.
May I come in?
Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I thought about that, too, and I think it really... Unfortunately, this is a mechanism for people with taxable income.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the challenge gets to be if there's not someone in the household who's working. And I think this might not be the best mechanism for a household where either parent is working. I understand what you're saying.
No, there would be a parent working. It would be the same circumstance. So the mom is working. The dad can't work because the dad needs to be taking the child to all of the medical appointments, the physical therapy appointments, being with the child during the hospitalization. The other children in the home, because one parent is working, the other parent is in the hospital caring for the child with a disability. It's the same situation. It's just the medical needs and disabilities are driven by that.
The roles are replaced.
The roles are replaced. It's the child that has the disability, but it still displaces one of the two parents from the workforce.
I see what you're saying. I think it would become down to how, and this might be a question for revenue, I'm assuming this is going to the revenue committee or would, but does it ever subsequent?
I think it will.
I think it comes down to clarifying how you verify, you would probably have to provide some verification of disability, but in this case, I think it'd be the question is how would you document that? Because I think you're right. I think you're identifying an issue where there's a reason a parent's not working, whether it's the medical needs of the child or the disability of the parent, and we're trying to make sure that somebody in that family continues to work and they need child care, and that's what the credit's for. So I think it comes down to how we might have to work out what's the mechanism for verifying that for revenues purposes, but it's really a very valid point.
Any other questions? And you wanted to say something, Mr. Hand.
I was just curious if you needed a little background on my disability.
No, I don't think so. I appreciate you offering that, but I think
okay. I was just,
we
I didn't know, so.
Yes,
thank you, Madam
Chair. I appreciate you offering. Thank you.
Can I address one of the questions that I believe came up, Madam Chair? When I met with Representative Kotek and was talking to her, she was concerned that a person who was disabled and put their kids in child care but was a single parent and didn't have working income coming in would qualify. The original bill act, whatever we refer to it as, put it so that there had to be a minimum income amount and a maximum income amount. So if somebody's making $80,000 a year and they have a disabled spouse, they do not qualify for the child care tax credit. Mm-hmm. And if they have no income at all, they do not qualify for it. There is a minimum and a maximum. I'm not exactly sure on them. I believe it's like $6,000 and $43,000 a year. So that kind of excludes those individuals that don't have a partner and have child care costs, you know, to go to their medical appointments or whatever. And then I do see the question that Representative Glazier put out there of caring for another individual. I have a coworker who has a son that requires frequent trips up to Dornbecker's, which takes her away from work. And under the Family Leave Act, she is covered but doesn't replace that income. So she has to put her youngest in daycare and then get up to Dornbecker's to take care of her older son. So I can see it would benefit other people.
Thank you, Ms. Hand. Any other questions? Thank you both so much.
Thank
for
you.
Thank you for your time.
Representative Crumble, did you come here to testify on this bill?
Okay.
Please come up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, State Representative Jerry Crummel, House District 26, Wilsonville, Sherwood, and over to Gaston. I have known Tim and Trish for a number of years and from a previous life. And earlier this year, they came to me and asked about this concept. I did mention to them that I would help them any way I could, and but I also wanted them to get to know their own state representative and senator. So I took them over to meet Senator Courtney, and also to meet Representative Clem. I think that this is an interesting scenario, and you know, as they talked to me about it, since they are in this situation, there are probably others that are in this situation too. And I think that if we're going to have tax credits available for people for child care, this is definitely an area where we have families that that need some help. With regards to the issues that Vice Chair Gelser was raising, I think that there's an opportunity to look at other parts of the tax law and see how we might be able to help families that are in those types of situations. And one of the things that I found is working with the Department of Revenue is very helpful in those kind of cases, because they're very willing to generally steer us in the right direction in those types to accomplish what it is that we're trying to accomplish. In this particular case, however, I think that this is a good remedy for the situation that the Hands actually face, and for other families who are in facing the same type of dilemma. I think that this is a very good remedy, because they have the situation where they have taxable income, but they are somewhat restricted in their availability of the child care tax credit at their particular income level. I think as a legislature, if we really want to help families with self-sufficiency, this bill helps us get there. And I would just make the request to the chair and to the committee that you schedule this bill for a work session and that you move it out to the floor, and let's get this on the books so that families such as the Hands can take advantage of this kind of an opportunity, so that their income isn't completely eaten up by child care expenses, and so that they can enjoy some of the other things that all of us are able to enjoy. With that, Madam Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions. Otherwise, I will take leave and go back to Ways and Means.
Thank you, Representative Crumble. Let's see if there are any questions from this committee. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
You bet. Thank you for testifying on this bill. Do you have anything else to add, Representative Holby?
Thank you, Madam Chair. State Representative Paul Holby again. Just wanted to reiterate that I appreciate the comments that came from Representative Gelser and think that's an issue we should look at. I'm just not sure this is quite the right vehicle to do that. Even though it's very closely related, it is something that maybe we could have revenue look at and see if there's a way to deal with that other scenario in this case. But I'm not positive it's workable in this particular vehicle, actually. But, this is, as I said, this is extremely important to families where parents do have one of the spouses or partners are disabled and they have children to take care of. It really puts an extreme economic burden on those families. And just this bill would be so helpful. My constituent that brought this to me last year at tax time, actually, and was very, very upset because they were struggling so hard to survive. And this would really help a lot of people, I think.
Thank you, Representative Holden. You and I have talked a little bit about this. Who will determine whether or not this disability is severe enough so that it keeps a member of the family from being able to either work or seek employment or go to school?
Well, I think that that's probably already done. It can be done through DHS and seeing what families are actually eligible for disability through our Social Security Administration or registered through the state. You know that they are bona fide disabled, and probably also another qualifier on that will have to be that somehow we establish they're unable to take care of the child, and those are exactly the pieces I want revenue to address. Is how we identify the disabled parents is specifically, I think there's, and I think Representative Gelser, I've had a conversation with her about that as well, and because I think folks are already identified as being disabled in our system, especially with DHS and even I think with sometimes the Department of Revenue. So I think we're halfway there.
And one of the things we discussed is that some people may be disabled to the extent that they would not be able to seek a job or hold a job or educate, but they might not be disabled to the point where they couldn't take care of their children. So will there be some definitions there that will be coming?
That's what we're hoping to, and I've talked to Representative Barnhart about this as well, looking into this and trying to further clarify or further define exactly that point.
And that would be done in revenue?
I'm hoping that will be done in revenue, yes.
Why wouldn't it be done in this committee?
Well, certainly that's the chair's prerogative. If you wish to take that on and do that in this committee, we can work on that and try to get an amendment drafted for you to hear that. My hope was to keep the bill moving so it makes it through the process, but I think we do have time to address it here in this committee if you choose to do that, or if you would like that to happen. I can certainly go back to LC and ask for an amendment to define that for us.
Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Holby, and I appreciate your tackling this issue, which is a difficult one. One of the questions that came to my mind after we had the conversation, and I was trying to ponder what that definition would look like and what would the implications be of DHS doing that,
Have you had any conversations with DHS or anyone about how to protect that parent should something happen to the working parent, who that person is in an accident or that person dies, and DHS through this process has determined that the surviving parent is unable to care for the child? Is there any concern about how that might impact the ability for that parent to maintain custody of that child if DHS has determined that person is unable to care for them?
Yeah, I haven't had that conversation specifically. I mean, it was sort of I understand where you're going, but to me it was unrelated to this specific bill, and I was really focused on getting this piece through to help parents that are in this situation.
Could I follow up to clarify? May I follow up to clarify, please?
Follow up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think that the reason I'm raising this question is that if you're going to legislative council, I would just want to make sure that if we're sending it to DHS to make the determination, that we aren't without intention in the creation of that definition, that we would want to be careful that there wasn't something that was prejudicing that person's ability to maintain custody of the child if the non-disabled parent were to die. I mean, when we talk about the ability to maintain safety and provide care, and the agency that makes that determination on the backside, I wouldn't want to see an unintended consequence of them losing the child.
Madam Chair, Tim Gelser, you make a very fine point, and certainly it would not be the intent that we would jeopardize anybody's custody with this kind of legislation. So, you know, I'll definitely point that out to LC and make sure that we take a look at what determines custody in a scenario like that, so we can try to avoid that kind of double jeopardy, I suppose.
Representative Kotek.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess in my mind I was thinking of a somewhat lower standard, because this could be a temporary. You know, we file taxes every year. There could be a 12-month period or less in the tax year that, because I'm assuming in the Hans case you might have provided test or some kind of written documentation from your doctor or something to that effect to the Department of Revenue, or if you, I'm just wondering what you submitted, because I think my impression was Revenue looked at that and said, sorry, that doesn't, I mean, they're like, well, you might have a disability and you might not be able to take care of your kid, but the bill's, you know, the law's written. I'm just wondering what you turned into them.
Well, I have been, just to give a little background as to the question of how people are determined to be disabled and unable to care for their children. I, of course, have gone through the process and been deemed disabled by DHS, and I have at least three, probably four doctors who have deemed me disabled by their definition and being unable to care for my child on any permanent or full-time basis due to my hospitalization periods and times, and not only that, the effects of my medications that I take.
Mr. Hand, I'm going to interrupt here. That's fine. We have to get on the floor.
Okay.
But I think our concern here is that if something were to happen to your wife, we would not want you to be put in the position where you would not be able to retain custody of your child.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. I misunderstood.
Yeah.
What I understood what you were asking, if something would happen to me, would my wife be able to?
No. Okay. We were worried if something would happen to your wife, we wanted to make sure that you would still be able to retain custody of your child.
I appreciate that.
You bet.
Okay.
You bet.
Can I just tell you that the tax...
You cannot speak from there. You can come up here.
Sorry.
And then we'll have to go...
Yeah. When we filed our taxes...
No, you've got to go through the process. Say who you are.
Patricia Hand.
Thank you.
When we filed our taxes, and before they denied us, they requested a note from our doctor stating that Tim was unable to care for his child. So they had Social Security saying he's disabled, unable to work, and a note from the doctor saying Tim's unable to care for his child. And even still after asking for that, they denied everything. But They did ask for that.
Thank you, Patricia.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Last statement, Representative.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. I think there is a difference between being eligible, you know, what makes somebody eligible to have custody and what makes somebody eligible for this particular tax credit, you know, because of a disability that doesn't make them able to, you know, really take care of somebody full time as needed. I think there is a difference there, and I will work with the committee and yourself, Madam Chair, and LC to try to clarify that so we don't have any unintended consequences.
Thank you so much. I need to close this hearing, closing the public hearing on House Bill 2752 and closing up the House Committee on Human Services and Women's Wellness. Thank you so much.